Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Rutger Bregman, the author of Utopia for Realists, the case for a universal basic income, open borders and a 15-hour work week. We will discuss his article at The Guardian, The Left Needs Fresh Ideas and a New Language If It Is to Win Again, and his critique of underdog socialists, who he sees as being against austerity, privatization and the establishment, while it's not clear what they are for, and whether, quoting, leftists actually like losing, as if the failure, doom and atrocities mainly serve to prove they were right all along, while their activism is more about bolstering identity than achieving results. Then, following a front-page story in Monday's Los Angeles Times that investigated the consequences of a nuclear accident 2 years ago at WIP, the Nuclear Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico, we will speak with Edwin Lyman, a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, who specializes in nuclear power safety and security. We will discuss the rising cost of this little-known nuclear accident that will likely cost $2 billion more than the Three Mile Island cleanup, and the daunting problems associated with the disposal of nuclear waste from civilian power reactors and the nuclear weapons industry that, in spite of billions spent, remains largely unaddressed. Then finally, we'll speak with William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and a columnist with the New York Times Deal Book section and a writer for Fortune magazine. He joins us to discuss the New York Times investigation into Donald Trump's finances that reveal he has at least $650 million in debt, twice the amount gleaned from public filings, and that while beating the drum on Hillary Clinton's speaking fees for Goldman Sachs, he is in debt to Goldman Sachs for tens of millions, along with the Bank of China, the state bank of a communist country Trump regularly condemns. And joining us now is Rutger Bregman, who is one of Europe's most prominent young thinkers, who has published 4 books on history, philosophy, and economics. He currently writes for The Correspondent, and his latest book is Utopia for Realists, The Case for a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Work Week. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Left Needs Fresh Ideas and a New Language If It Is to Win Again. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rutger Bregman.
Yes, thanks for having me.
A pleasure, Rutger. And first of all, it seems that the traditional political duopolies in Europe between the socialists and the conservatives, and here in the United States between the Republicans and Democrats, is breaking down in this election we're having. Donald Trump, who's running as a Republican, is certainly not a traditional Republican. And on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, a self-declared socialist, gave Hillary Clinton quite a competition. So, and it's pretty clear in Europe that the parties are breaking down. So is there a sort of a rejection underway for these duopolies, and are people turning, I know they're turning to the far right with Le Pen and other, and UKIP, et cetera.
But definitely.
Are they turning to the far
right? I think what we see in Europe is pretty much the same as in the U.S. So the forces that made Trump, you know, they're also active in Europe. If you just look at what happened in the UK with Brexit, I think that many people who voted for Brexit just wanted to say no to the establishment. So there's a great line from an English writer, Laurie Penny, who said that if you only have a hammer, then everything looks like the face of David Cameron. And I think that the same sentiment you see that in country after country, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Germany, in England, and in the U.S. as well.
Well, Donald Trump, by the way, is not by any means over, even though Hillary Clinton's ahead in the polls. There's some rather there's some rather disturbing statistics coming out now where, for example, Republican registration is way up in key swing states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida.
And I think that's the same with Brexit. You know, everyone believed that Brexit wouldn't happen until it suddenly happened. So, yeah, I definitely don't believe that the Trump phenomenon is over. Just like for in the country where I live, the Netherlands, the party that's in the top of the poll is the Freedom Party from Geert Wilders. Now, he is much more radical than Trump actually is. So he says that there should be a headscarf tax for Muslim women, and that, you know, Muslim youth should be put away in concentration camps. He's probably going to win the elections next year. So, as I said, this is a phenomenon that we see in many countries, not only in the U.S.
Well, ironically, of course, the United States, after World War II, with the Marshall Plan, established or helped establish social democracies in Europe, but they didn't allow the United States to have social democracy, even though FDR, one of his last addresses, talked about a new Bill of Rights, which was essentially a blueprint for social democracy. So we have, for the first time with the Bernie Sanders, we've had a manifestation of an appeal for social democracy, particularly amongst the young, because they've been turned into profit centers by Wall Street instead of investment centers. And the Wall Street is now about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. So not only do you have a crisis on the left here, although you may there may be some sort of revival underway, you certainly have a crisis on the right with capitalism itself.
Definitely. And I think that the difference here between the U.S. and Europe is that, you know, Europe already has universal health care in many countries. And in my country where I live, the Netherlands, we've had free education for years. So these demands from the Bernie Sanders movement don't sound quite radical to us. You know, they sound just like simple milestones of civilization that the U.S. should have had years before. But what we also see happening is that with the traditional social democratic movements that always dreamed about full employment and that have mostly focused on the male wage earner, you know, many of these old ideas are running out of steam. And we see that happening all over the place. So what I think is that the problem of the left in Europe and in the U.S. is that it doesn't have new ideas for a radically different world. It doesn't really have new demands for how the economy should function in the 21st century. So that was what my piece was about in The Guardian.
Well, but, you know, it struck me because I've often said on this radio program that the American left, you know, I often feel like I'm on the right side with the wrong people, that the American left is more interested in being self-righteous than being effective. The right in this country, extremely effective.
Yeah.
They don't care about intellectual inconsistencies and they just go ahead and win. But when you say leftists actually like losing, as if the failure, doom and atrocities mainly serve to prove they were right all along, and also that their activism is more about bolstering identity than achieving results, that certainly resounds here, because that seems to be, unfortunately, the case.
Yeah, and it's a huge problem, you know, with people on the left. I think that the problem often isn't that they're wrong or anything, but simply that they lack a winning strategy. So one thing that Donald Trump understands very, very, very well is that most people like to be on the winning side. But what the left always does is appeal to people who are on the losing side. So the dropouts, the poor, the immigrants, etc. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have any solidarity with these kind of groups, but I think you also need a strategy to win over middle-class people who aren't so much on the losing side, but, you know, just want to be on the winning side. And that's really a problem with what I call underdog socialism.
Of course, not only is the U.S. not a social democracy, even though it helped create social democracies in post-war Europe, it's also the left, after FDR, got shrunk enormously during the Cold War by the canard that was floated that if you are progressive on domestic issues, you are therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet Union. And it shrunk enormously. And the really exciting thing about Bernie Sanders is that he's making it clear that young Americans, the millennials, they don't buy all that Cold War history and all of that nonsense anymore and all of that.
Definitely, yeah.
And they're basically looking for a new paradigm. So the United States is ripe for a revival on the left. It's just that I don't see it happening anywhere. And the radio network that I broadcast from, the Pacifica Network, is the most powerful asset on the political left in terms of a media asset. And it's heading to bankruptcy because of insane internal political struggles, factionalization, and the stifling of rational discourse by conspiracy theories and wannabe lumpenproletariat revolutionary rantings. So, you know, in many ways we're at a deficit here in the United States because, you know, communism was so demonized. And of course, you can make the case that the communists were the ones that gave socialism a bad name.
Yeah, definitely. You know, what I think is that the defining moment for the generation that is now in power was the fall of the Berlin Wall, so 1989. But the defining moment for my generation, I'm 28 years old, and I was born only 1 year before the fall of the Berlin Wall. The defining moment was, in the first place, 9/11, of course, and in the second place, the Wall Street crash of 2008, and then the financial crash that, you know, engulfed the whole world. Those are the defining moments for my generation. So I think what's happening is now is that we're moving beyond this whole idea that we've somehow arrived at the end of history. And people are, especially young people, they don't buy many of the old dogmas anymore, that inequality is always a good thing, or that redistribution is a bad thing, or that Wall Street always creates more wealth. Many of these dogmas are all, you know, being destroyed at the moment. But the thing is that the old people are still in power. So in that sense, you simply need a little bit of patience, you know. Great historical paradigm shifts, they don't happen in just a few years. It takes some time. But I think that, you know, I have good hope that when we'll look back in 10 or maybe 20 years, then we'll see this period that we're living through now as a really defining moment in Western history, and that many of the ideas that were for a long time regarded as bizarre and utopian, that they are becoming more and more acceptable right now. And indeed, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement has shown this, that many of his ideas were seen as ludicrous and bizarre for a long time. And just if you repeat them long enough, we want universal health care, we want free education for everyone, we want a minimum wage of $15. And in my case, what I argue for is we want a universal basic income, we want a shorter work week, et cetera, et cetera. And all these things sound bizarre initially, but if you keep talking about them, keep trying to convince people that at some point what's regarded as bizarre at some point simply becomes a milestone of civilization. I think that's how progress happens.
But how do you motivate this inchoate movement that has the potential to become a majority very quickly? One of the arguments I often make is that the Republican Party was essentially taken over by the far right wing Tea Party. And so the question then is, why can't the progressives take over the Democratic Party? And they almost did under Bernie Sanders. But I mentioned earlier that the registration amongst Republicans has gone up tremendously under Trump, particularly in important states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, whereas registration, for example, in California went up enormously for Bernie Sanders. But guess what? Many of those who registered to vote for Bernie didn't vote. So you have this
sort of... Yeah, and this is one of the reasons that, you know, from my perspective across the pond, is what I'm really fearful about is that Americans face a choice between, you know, a fascist and a neoliberal friend of bankers. That's not really a choice, right? That's not really what democracy should look like. So that is frightening. I completely agree with you. And it shows, I guess, that organizing is extremely important. But what's also important in the long run, I guess, is that you sort of have to hijack the words that the right has now almost conquered. So there are many words like progress or reform or efficiency. You know, these were once, 40, 50 years, they were all leftist words. So progress and technology, these were all regarded as leftist. And the conservatives, they were against all those kind of things. Nowadays, it's completely turned around. Often the forces of progress and reform are regarded as right-wing forces. Now, what I think that you need to do is that you have to pack your quite radical utopian proposals into mainstream language. You have to sort of reconquer the language of progress, so that you show that your reforms, for example, that you want to eradicate poverty, and just show that it's an investment that will pay for itself. So you have to sound quite mainstream, but at the same time, propose utopian, quite radical ideas. And Bernie Sanders was quite good at it, but yeah, alas, he didn't make it, but he came quite far.
Well, but if he's about to start campaigning after Labor Day for Hillary Clinton, and he ran as a Democrat, even though he's the longest serving independent in U.S. political history and a self-identified socialist. Mm-hmm. But Hillary Clinton is not a good candidate. She's not doing well. And Trump was a catastrophe looming. And it's not inconceivable because of our first past the post. You know, under the U.S. systems, you make your coalitions before the elections, whereas in the European parliamentary system, you make them after the elections. And so, you know, mm-hmm. if the Green Party gets the 5% that they're polling at now, that could basically essentially elect Donald Trump, because the Greens don't have mm-hmm. they basically all they have is rhetoric. There's no record. They've never held office except for the mayor of Santa Monica. So they don't have a record to run on. They essentially run on rhetoric. And their only achievement was to swing the election in 2000 in Florida for George W. Bush, which resulted in the most catastrophic presidency in American history. So that's the unfortunate aspect of the American system.
I completely agree. You know, it's the same in many other countries, like the UK and Canada, which is the first past the post system. I think that, you know, actual democracy should be a proportional system, not a system where you have only like two choices. But you know what I think that should happen is that people who participated in the Bernie Sanders movement should, you know, in a certain sense, be realistic. And you know, if there's a choice between electing a fascist and a neoliberal, then try to change the try to put as much pressure as you can on the neoliberal to change her views. And I think that's Bernie Sanders' strategy. And I think it shows that he's basically a decent and honorable man who's not into sort of the Bernie or bust idea, which I think is completely defeatist. I mean, there are young people growing up right now, and they want to live in the best possible country and not in a bust country. So, yeah, but I completely agree with you. These choices are very difficult, and it's a dark line.
But the choice between a fascist and a neoliberal, I mean, I know it sounds like a not a very appetizing choice, but Donald Trump is such a catastrophe. Right. you really would have to be brain dead not to recognize that. In any case, Rutger, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I'm so glad you joined us, and let's stay in touch because I'm interested in your work, and I'd like to talk about it further.
Oh, that's great to hear.
And again, I've been speaking with Rutger Bregman, who's one of Europe's most prominent young thinkers, who has published 4 books on history, philosophy, and economics. He currently writes for The Correspondent, and his latest book is Utopia for Realists, The Case for a Universal Basic Income, Open Borders, and a 15-Hour Workweek. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Left Needs Fresh Ideas and a New Language If It Is to Win Again. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking further into the story in Monday's Los Angeles Times that investigated the consequence of a little-known nuclear accident 2 years ago at the nuclear waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you've never gone
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edwin Lyman, who's a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and an internationally recognized expert on nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, as well as nuclear power safety and security. the former president of the Nuclear Control Institute. He has testified numerous times before Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edwin Lyman.
Hello.
And the sort of the last cycle of the nuclear production of both weapons and power has always been troublesome, and that is, what do you do about the nuclear waste? And it was the Department of Energy came up with this depository of nuclear waste in a salt mine in New Mexico, and they spent quite a lot of money on it, and it was considered to be the solution, and all of the nuclear waste that's piling up at the various facilities in Hanford, Washington State, and around the country were going to be deposited there. But 2 years ago, there was an underground explosion where a drum containing plutonium and americium waste exploded. And this now turns out to be, according to a front page story in Monday's Los Angeles Times, that this may end up being the most expensive nuclear accident in American history.
The event was remarkable, and I think the LA Times estimate is eye-opening, because the accident itself did not have much impact on the environment. There was a radiological release of plutonium and americium from a waste drum, and it contaminated the working space, the interior of the repository, very little actually left the site and entered the environment. So the cost of the accident is not because there's a lot of cleanup to be done on the surface, let's say what we're seeing in Fukushima, but it really is because the event has disrupted the schedule for disposing of the waste that is scheduled to go to this facility, which is called transuranic waste, and those disruptions have an impact all over the country and can be very costly.
But the theory has always been that this is the safest way, because you're talking about plutonium that has a half-life of 25,400 years. So this is supposed to be not just a temporary, this is supposed to be as permanent gets, right? So the questions then would be, the theory would be that these salt mines would eventually collapse and seal in these drums?
That's right. One of the properties of the salt formations is that they are kind of soft. So they excavate rooms and they place waste drums, essentially 55-gallon metal drums, into these rooms, stack them up, and over time the rooms will actually collapse because the salt creeps and eventually will essentially form an impermeable barrier around the waste drums. And the other property of a salt mine is that it's very dry. There's no water in there, because if there was any water, then the salt would dissolve and there wouldn't be any salt left. So the safety basis for WIP is predicated on the notion that it stays dry and that essentially nothing leaks out of the site. But the problem that was experienced here is in the so-called pre-closure period, where there was an event within one of the waste drums that contaminated the working space of the repository.
But doesn't that indicate a problem with storing nuclear waste, and that is that any kind of slight alteration in the composure of how the nuclear waste is dispersed, in this case it's dispersed amongst what is kitty litter in effect. So if that's the problem, that it wasn't properly packaged inside these drums, if the salt collapses and compresses, wouldn't some of these drums then be broken open, and that could change the composition of the material inside and then lead to a nuclear event?
Well, no. The theory is that if you control the content of the drums, which is what didn't happen in this case, there was a failure in their quality assurance program, but if the drums contain the waste that they're supposed to contain and they meet the criteria for the repository, then you wouldn't expect this kind of energetic chemical reaction to occur. And so you would just have, the salt formation compacting and encasing this waste, and there wouldn't be any driving force. You know, you wouldn't have a chemical reaction that would create heat. So obviously the challenge here was that they violated procedures by changing the type of kitty litter that they use. And I know it sounds very high-tech here, but what they use the kitty litter for is essentially to absorb excess liquids within these drums. And what happened at Los Alamos National Laboratory is there was an unapproved change of the type of kitty litter that was used from a material that was clay-based and didn't contain carbon, didn't have organic material, and they switched it to one that had organic material or carbon in it, and that change catalyzed a reaction which led to the overpressure of the drum. So it really goes back to making sure that you know what is going into the drums. But one problem is that the waste that is destined for this repository, which is from all over the nuclear weapons complex and contains a lot of legacy wastes from the Cold War, that sometimes they don't know very well everything that's in these drums, and they have to make guesses. So, you know, there is a possibility that that things like this can happen in the future, but the controls in place are supposed to prevent that.
So there are some 24,000 drums of this nuclear waste that goes back to the original nuclear weapons program up in Hanford, Washington State. And it has to be regularly inspected. And as you mentioned, it's not entirely clear that the contents of the drums are necessarily properly inventoried. But the fact that this site in New Mexico was supposed to take care of what's been stored and monitored there in Hanford has created a political problem, has it not? The governor of Washington State is not happy with the federal government. So even though the explosion of this drum in this site may not be as big a deal, certainly not $2 billion worth, where does this $2 billion price tag come into play then? How is it that it could extrapolate out to $2 billion, which is
big? Yes, I think the estimate really just comes from the impact of the delay in accepting waste that will lead to extending the operating life of the repository. And according to the article, each year it costs about $200 million to operate. So it's just simple math that you delay by several years, you're going to get additional billion or more dollars in over the original estimate. So the system is very intolerant of delays. And that's why this could turn out to be a very costly accident for the Energy Department.
And isn't there also plans for a similar waste repository in Nevada that Harry Reid and the citizens of Nevada have blocked?
Yes. Well, to clarify, there are different types of nuclear waste. So the so-called Yucca Mountain repository in Nevada, which was canceled by the Obama administration, was where the commercial spent nuclear fuel from nuclear power plants was supposed to go. That was the main content of that repository. And commercial spent fuel is a different type of beast. It's a solid material. It's a hard ceramic. It has contaminants in it that occur when the material is irradiated, called fission products. Some of them are in the form of gases. But each fuel rod is encased in a zirconium sheath. And most of the time, that remains intact. So so it's a different type of waste. You wouldn't expect a violent chemical reaction to occur in that waste, but it That's why a repository has to be designed to take into account the fact that that material will slowly corrode. But those repositories are not generally designed to deal with, a large, some sort of energetic accident in the waste like you saw it at WIP. So it's a different type of material. Right now, there is no repository site for commercial spent fuel, so it's just accumulating at reactor sites, and that isn't a great option either, partly because much of that fuel is stored in swimming pools, what are called the spent fuel pools, where they're submerged in water, and that water has to be continually cooled in order to keep the fuel at a safe temperature. And that fuel really should be moved to dry casks, which are essentially concrete and steel structures where smaller quantities of fuel can be loaded, but those casks would be fairly stable. But because it would cost money to actually buy and load those casks, the nuclear utilities prefer to keep most of their fuel in the spent fuel pools, and that could be a big problem if there were an accident or a terrorist attack that caused that fuel to drain out. You could have a large radiological release that could contaminate hundreds of square miles. It would make what happened at WIP look like child's play. So it is very important to get that material out of the spent fuel pools and eventually into a geologic repository. But, of course, the repository has to be designed and operated in a safe way so that you don't have unintended consequences.
Well, indeed, I think a terrorist with a rocket-propelled grenade could punch a hole in the concrete wall of a swimming pool, and then once the water drains out, then you could have a meltdown if the rods are still hot. The explosion that you just described could be catastrophic. All of this leads one to the conclusion that when we talk about nuclear power, particularly in the context of global warming as being a solution to the problem of greenhouse gases, the end use of it, the last cycle, is always sort of glossed over, isn't it? And the more you talk about it, the more daunting the problems become.
That's right. And, back at the dawn of the nuclear power era, the National Academy of Sciences looked at the issue of nuclear waste disposal. This is back, in the 50s. And they decided then that nuclear waste disposal was not a technical problem. It was a political problem. And so, therefore, there was no need to worry unduly about the prospects that they believed it would certainly happen. And what has happened is the industry and the regulators and the Department of Energy have kicked the ball down the court each time the issue has come up. What are we going to do with the waste? So the prospects for safe nuclear waste disposal are always very good, but still in the future. And that's, again, where we are today. Is that the goalpost keeps being moved, and the outcome is accumulating spent fuel in spent fuel pools where it is not as safe as it could be and continues to threaten the public.
But the fact that, just going back to the nuclear waste from the weapons programs, and there's an awful lot of it, let's talk a little bit about, in the last couple of minutes, Ed Lyman, about the this big, big plant down in South Carolina that Senator Lindsey Graham has championed. It's cost, I think, about $7 billion so far. And the last I heard was that they're going to close it, but it was supposed to take care of plutonium waste, was it not?
Yes, this is a related issue in that the U.S. has a lot of plutonium, which is a waste product because it comes from nuclear weapons that we no longer need for our nuclear arsenal. So the equivalent of many thousands of nuclear weapons of plutonium is something we don't need anymore. So the U.S. has been looking for more than 20 years for a way to dispose of that material in a way that would minimize the risk that it could be stolen. And unfortunately, the option that was chosen by the George W. Bush administration was to turn it into reactor fuel in a facility called the Mox Fuel Fabrication Plant, and that's the plant you're referring to at South Carolina. They started building it in 2007. They said they thought it would cost only a couple of billion dollars at that time, and it would be up and running in a few years. Fast forward to 2016, the current estimate for the program is now upwards of $30 to $50 billion. And the plant won't even start operating for a decade or more. So the Obama administration wants to dig itself out of this hole and essentially cancel the plant and pursue another alternative for disposing that plutonium. But the state of South Carolina and the delegation, Senator Lindsey Graham and others, have been blocking DOE's plan and essentially forcing DOE to continue spending money to build the plant that they don't want and that will probably never operate. So this is a boondoggle of historic proportions. But the wrinkle is that the department's backup plan, instead of using the MOX plant, is to dilute the plutonium and to send it to WIPP. So until the accident in 2014, this looked like a sure thing because WIPP was the best operating, one of the department's best operating facilities. It opened in 1989 and hadn't had any significant problems. But once the accident happened and the repository closed temporarily, then Senator Graham could go to DOE and say, well, we're not going to let you cancel the MOX plant because you don't have an alternative. If your alternative is sending it to WIPP, then that's not an alternative because it's shut down. So we're very supportive of the department's plan to dispose of that plutonium by sending it to WIPP. So we are very hopeful that the facility will be cleaned up and resume full operation soon. But even if it takes 5 years or more, or more than that, it's still you could still dispose of weapons plutonium more quickly than if you continued building and operating the MOX plant. So as badly as the department screwed up with WIPP, we still think it has a chance to redeem itself by restoring the repository to operation and shutting down the MOX project and sending diluted plutonium to be buried underground where it can't be reused in weapons.
Well, just in the last minute, my understanding is that one of the reactors that melted down at Fukushima was MOX-fueled. Is that right?
There was a small amount of MOX fuel in Fukushima Daiichi Unit 3.
Right.
My assessment is that didn't have a big impact on the accident because it was such a small fraction. It was only a few percent. But the plan in Japan is to use much larger fractions of plutonium to try to get rid of their excess plutonium. In fact, they just restarted a plant called Ikata Number 3, which does have MOX fuel in the core. So if you had an accident like Fukushima and there was more MOX fuel in the core, then you would have a larger amount of plutonium getting out into the environment. That would have made the accident even worse. So that's something we have to worry about here if the government continues to pursue a plan for using MOX fuel in commercial reactors here. That's why it's safer to just directly dispose of it underground.
Well, Edmund Lyman, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Edwin Lyman, who's a senior scientist at the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists and an internationally recognized expert on nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, as well as nuclear power safety and security. The former president of the Nuclear Control Institute, he has testified numerous times before Congress and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the New York Times investigation into Donald Trump's finances that reveal he has at least $650 million of debt, twice the amount gleaned from previous public filings.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Cohan, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He currently has a column in the New York Times Deal Book section and is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and a writer for Fortune. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, thank you, Bill. And the New York Times, your paper, among others outlets, had a very, very detailed investigative piece in Monday's edition, Trump's Empire, A Maze of Debts and Opaque Ties. And I'm pretty sure you're familiar with it, but it basically reveals that Trump has about $650 million in debt, twice what had originally been thought. And some of his creditors include Goldman Sachs. And of course, he rails against Hillary Clinton all the time for taking speaking fees from Goldman Sachs when his indebtedness is in the tens of millions. And of course, the other aspect that got a lot of people's attention was that he's also indebted to a communist Chinese state bank. And of course, as we all know, in his campaigns, he rails against the Chinese. So I know in politics there's a lot of hypocrisy, but how much is this is on the surface? It seems flagrantly hypocritical, but I take it it's a slightly more complicated than that.
Well, there are subtleties, of course, especially in finance, where there's a lot of nuance and a lot of complicated deal arrangements and financings, and no more so than in real estate. And, of course, one thing our good friend Donald Trump knows is how to take advantage of a good real estate deal. And so I think you have to make a distinction between sort of the buildings that he owns outright, say Trump Tower, or where he has a ground lease for a long period of time, say 40 Wall Street, and the debt associated with those buildings, where he's either the majority owner or the majority controller of various corporations that own these buildings. And those are the buildings that he showed the debt of on his Federal Election Commission reports in a range. And that was what was sort of adding up to, like, say, rough numbers, $350 million. And the new debt that Sue Craig at the New York Times sort of calculated relates to basically his portion of, based on his ownership, a minority ownership of other buildings that he owns in New York, San Francisco, and other places where he's not the majority owner. He's partnered with other big equity real estate investors. And he's just an equity owner in a limited liability corporation that has an equity interest in, say, this building at on 6th Avenue here in New York that's near Rockefeller Center, you know, which is, you know, worth a lot of money and has a lot of debt on it. But he is not guaranteeing that debt, and so it wouldn't be necessarily on the hook for it. Goldman Sachs and the Chinese bank have lent against this building, secured by the building itself. So if for whatever reason Trump and Vornado Realty, which is the majority holder, don't make the payments, the interest payments on that debt, which seems unlikely, let's face it, unless for some reason the tenants in the building just decide to leave suddenly, which isn't likely. But if for some reason they weren't to make those payments, then the recourse to Goldman Sachs and the Chinese bank would have would be to take the building, to foreclose on the building, take control of the building, and then sell it to repay themselves back. And what that would mean is that, that Donald Trump would lose his equity investment, but it's not like he's on the hook for the full debt that the building itself took on. And so, you know, there are some subtleties. What I think that the piece really shows incredibly well, and Sue did a great job at this, is showing how complicated, how much more complicated his financial and business relationships are than he has ever let on. And you know, don't forget, I mean, this is a guy who runs a private business empire. As a result of it being private, he doesn't file any public statements with the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's barely regulated. He doesn't have to release his financial results. He doesn't have to provide any financial projections. It's not like there are research analysts on Wall Street who cover his company. As we've talked about before, you know, Wall Street banks don't want to do business with him directly because he's defaulted on so many previous loans made that banks had made to him that they don't want to do business with him. So as a result, what you have, Ian, is this fellow, Donald Trump, who's claiming to be worth $10 billion. Some days he claims to be worth $11 billion, but has never released one iota of financial information about his company that would lead you to conclude that he's worth that much. You don't have a full picture of his debt, as the New York Times so elegantly portrayed. We don't have his tax returns, so we don't know how much income he makes in a given year. We don't know how much tax he pays. We don't know how much he pays gives away in charity. We don't really know anything about this guy or who his creditors are or who has their hooks into him or anything like that. And so I think that more than just, you know, that he may have more debt than he disclosed, some of which is not recourse to him. I think the more interesting question is, you know, what are the complexities of this guy's business arrangements, none of which he's ever really revealed and feels no obligation to reveal. And I think, you know, as somebody who might potentially be president of the United States, and, you know, frankly, let's hope not, but if in fact he is president of the United States, who knows who his relationships are with, or who has a side door entrance to be able to have a conversation or influence him. And that's the real danger of Donald Trump.
And, of course, the possibility of Donald Trump becoming president doesn't go away because of the success of Hillary Clinton while he was floundering and saying outrageous statements. He tanked in the polls, but now there's some adult supervision, it appears, and he's, I think, climbing back a little bit in the polls. But there are other aspects to this race that are quite troubling for those who are terrified of the specter of Donald Trump becoming president of the United States. New Republican registration is way up in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and in Florida. And there's, you know, Kellyanne Conway, his campaign manager, is saying that there's undercover voters. In other words, people don't declare to pollsters that they're going to vote for Donald Trump. So you can't write him off. What do you think is going to force him to... I mean, here he is yesterday saying that the Clinton Foundation is the most corrupt enterprise in political history. I mean, extraordinary hyperbole there. And yet you don't know anything about him. And if you hide things... The assumption is if you're hiding something, there's a reason you're hiding it, isn't there?
Well, I think in Donald Trump's case, he absolutely is hiding things. He obviously, it's easy for him, for whatever reason, he's made the calculation, and it's worked for him so far for reasons which I frankly don't understand, but it has worked that, you know, people seem to are attracted to him because he claims to be worth $10 billion or $11 billion. Well, he's never provided one stick of evidence to prove that number. Now, why somebody would exaggerate that, I don't know, but he's clearly exaggerating. Normally, to make a valuation of what somebody might, their net worth might be, especially if they own a business and so much of his net worth is based on that business, is to have projections for that business, sort of vet them and discount those cash flows back, a so-called discounted cash flow analysis. Well, you can't do that if he doesn't make any of his projections available, and he has steadfastly refused to do that. Another way to get at it would be to look at his income tax and see what his income was for any given year, and then you could sort of extrapolate based on that. And you could see, of course, and of course he hasn't done that, and you could see, you know, how much tax he pays. And normally we like our presidential candidates not to be scam artists when it comes to tax evasion. And I'm sure that Donald Trump fails that miserably because I'm sure he pays very little tax, or else I'm sure he'd be willing to release his tax forms. You'd also see how charitable he is. Now, there's no requirement that anybody be charitable, but, you know, for all the talk he's said of giving away millions of dollars to various charitable organizations, you know, there's, again, very little evidence that he actually does what he says he's going to do. So here you have this guy who's, you know, let's say he's richer than most of the country. I mean, I don't know whether, let's just stipulate that he's a billionaire. I mean, I really have a doubt that he's worth $10 billion or $11 billion, but he's worth more than 99.99% of the country. He lives in a triplex apartment on Fifth Avenue that is sort of filled with pink marble. He flies around on a private 757 jet. Why do the people who support him, who, you know, they're hard to categorize by and large, but, you know, a lot of them are sort of disaffected white males who have not benefited in this economy in the last 10 years and for some reason blame President Obama for everything, why those people think that this guy who flies around on a private 757 jet and lives in a triplex pink mausoleum in the sky above Fifth Avenue, among other lavish residents, including Mar-a-Lago in Florida, et cetera, cares one whit about them and will do anything to help them, you know, boggles my mind. And so I don't see why people support him. He hasn't given any evidence, in more than a year to back up any of the claims that he's making about his net worth or his value or his income or his justification for why he would do good things for the economy. In fact, the only thing that we know about Donald Trump is that he's put at least four of his businesses into bankruptcy, and he's taken advantage of people who have thoughtfully lent him money and not paid them back. And this is the guy that we want to be the steward of the largest economy on the face of the earth and steer us, you know, through, you know, potentially difficult times ahead? I don't think so. But, you know, there you have it. I can't explain why people support this guy, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
But what do you think he means, though, Donald Trump, when he says, "I love debt, I'm good at debt"?
I think it means sort of just what he said. Whatever wealth he has been created on the backs of other people's money. He has borrowed all this money because that's what real estate guys do. They constantly use other people's money to create wealth. Oftentimes, as we've seen with Donald Trump, they go into bankruptcy and they pick themselves up and go on and borrow more money and do it all over again. Sometimes when you buy real estate at the right time, you, despite how much leverage you put on it, a rising tide can lift all boats. And Donald Trump has benefited, no doubt, from owning some, you know, very interesting Manhattan real estate at a time when the value of real estate in Manhattan has gone up across the board. So, he's benefited from that. He uses as much debt as he possibly can. Again, Wall Street won't really lend him much money anymore, so he's sort of gone to tertiary firms like Deutsche Bank and Ladder Capital that lend him money, again, secured by the buildings that he's buying, which, of course, is their security, as opposed to expecting Donald to make good on a guarantee. And, you know, this is a guy who, you know, is supposedly wants us all to think he's financially savvy. Well, he's frankly not particularly financially savvy. He's opportunistic, and he gets people to lend him money. And then he his exit strategy is not to pay them back, but figure that he owes them so much money that the way out of it for them is to keep him around and try to help him work out of the debt that he owes them and hasn't repaid.
Well, this is why there's a lot of speculation. David K. Johnson's got a book about him, about Trump. Jim Henry is also looking into some of his offshore activities. And they're looking at the Russians and at the a possible confluence of interest there, where Trump can't raise money from traditional banks because he's blackballed. But on the Russian side, Putin's inner circle are all under sanctions. The Siloviki, his cronies who've literally bled Russia for billions and billions of dollars. And they need a place to put their money because they're, they can't use the international banking system. So is there anything to those rumors, do you think, Bill Cohen?
Well, you know, it's hard to know, how murky it gets between, Donald Trump and Russian oligarchs or the Russian government. I mean, it's obviously makes sense to me that Vladimir Putin would prefer Donald Trump be president of the United States than Hillary Clinton, with whom he has no relationship and they have mutual disdain for each other. I don't know why Putin thinks that Trump would be any better, but he might at the moment. I'm sure that if the occasion arose, Trump would turn on Putin in a nanosecond, because I don't think he has any loyalty to anybody, and I don't think he is a man of his word. In other words, I don't think just because he says something, that means he's going to follow through and do it. But it's hard to know. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of Trump getting financing from Russian banks. But if he defaults on any more loans to people, he may have and he wants to keep in business. He may have no choice but to go to a Russian bank at some point.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen. He's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He currently has a column in the New York Times Deal Book section and is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and a writer for Fortune magazine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.